Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning, December 21. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, and you can hear us from anywhere online at 883wppb.org. And you can hear this show on podcasts and on my website archived at annliguori.com. This morning, I had the pleasure of talking with Alec Sokoloff, the screenwriter of movies such as Toy Story, Cheaper by the Dozen, Money Talk, Garfield, so many other movies. And perhaps Alec is best known out here on the East End for co-hosting Sundays on the East End with none other than Bridget Leroy, which airs Sunday mornings from 11 to noon. Excellent, excellent addition to our programming lineup here on this radio station. So this morning, you'll hear Alec and I just conversing on a variety of topics. Just had a great time kind of getting to know Alec, and so I'll share that conversation with you. And in the second part of the show, we'll take a walk down memory lane and listen to a sports interview, a classic interview I did, a TV show that I did with the great Rocky Blyer. Now, Rocky Blyer helped Notre Dame win a national championship, but you guys probably remember him from the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was drafted by the Steelers in 1968, but in December of that year, after just 10 games in Pittsburgh, he actually was drafted into the United States Army. And he volunteered to fight in the Vietnam War. And in a matter of months, he went from like an NFL running back to a specialist in the 196th Light Infantry Brigade. And then in 69, in August in Vietnam, he was searching for some wounded comrades in a jungle when his platoon was ambushed, and he was hit during that ambush, got a bullet wound on his left leg. He had shrapnel from a grenade in his leg as well. Doctors said he would never walk again, but while rehabbing in Tokyo from all this craziness, the bullet wounds and the shrapnel, this founder and owner of the Steelers, Art Rooney, sent him a letter, and it said, "Rock, the team's not doing well. We need you, Art Rooney." Well, the rest, as they say, is history. Rocky Blyer returned to the NFL. He helped the Steelers go on to win 4 Super Bowls. In fact, he and Franco Harris became the most successful running back, fullback combo in NFL history, becoming the second pair of teammates in the NFL to ever rush for over 1,000 yards in a season back in 1976. So the story of Rocky Blyer is so inspirational and so incredible. And he continues to give motivational speeches around the country. He's written several books. And I was just so thrilled to have the chance to sit down with the great Rocky Blyer and hear his success story. And this morning, you will hear that conversation as well. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And before we do, let's look at some of the top sports stories of the year. And that is the new golf rules coming down from the Royal and Ancient and the USGA, which are going to be implemented in 2019. So a couple of them that really stick out to me is that players now will be permitted to leave the flag stick in the hole while playing a shot from the green. There will be no penalty if the ball strikes the flag stick. Of course, in the past, you know, you had to pull the flag stick out of the hole or somebody else do it, whether it was a caddy or another golfer, or tend and pull the flag stick before the ball struck it. Well, that rule has changed to help speed up play. Now, you can leave the flag stick in the hole on the green when you're putting, which is just incredible. That's a huge change, but maybe it will speed up play a bit. Players will be allowed to repair ball marks like shoe damage, including spike marks, any kind of scrapes or indentations caused by equipment or a flag stick, while, you know, before they putt. So you can actually repair all this stuff. You can remove loose sand or soil on the green surface or on the teeing area, but not anywhere else on the course. So that's a big change, and that could slow down play. Another big change, well, remember back in the U.S. Open at Oakmont in 2016 when Dustin Johnson's ball moved on the green as he made practice swings near the ball? Well, that was a huge story because what made it even bigger was the officials waited until the very end of the round to decide on the ruling, creating uncertainty about where the player stood on the leaderboard, and it just caused all kinds of chaos and controversy. Well, Dustin Johnson eventually won that U.S. Open by 3 shots, but after his round ended, he was penalized by a stroke. It could have resulted in an even bigger mess had he not had such a lead, but now the new rules say there will be no penalty if a player accidentally causes a ball or a ball marker to move on a green, even if the player touches the ball with the club while addressing it before a stroke or kicks it while bending over to mark it. A player must simply move the ball back to its original spot. So that's huge. That's going to be, you know, that is so different and obviously a big change and caused by all that controversy back in 2016. So, and one other one that, well, a couple other ones that stick out. In the past, it was against the rules to test or touch the sand in a bunker or to remove natural loose impediments that might get in the way of a swing. Well, now players will be able to remove loose impediments such as stones, leaves, or twigs without penalty. They simply pick them up and move them, and there will be no penalty. Boy, there's a lot of them. Players now have 3 minutes to search for a lost ball instead of 5 minutes. Obviously, that rule change is made to speed up play. And if you have to take a drop, players should drop the ball from knee height instead of shoulder height whenever a drop is specified for relief. So those are a few. If you have a chance and you are really, you know, serious about the game, go to the USGA's website and review the new rule changes, which will be implemented in 2019, so that you're familiar with these changes. In other news, Missy Franklin, who earned 4 gold medals at the 2012 Olympics in London and 6 gold medals at the 2013 World Championships and another gold at the 2016 Olympics, well, she has announced her retirement from swimming due to chronic shoulder issues. She's only 23 years old. But she said she's looking at her retirement from swimming as a new beginning. Well, it's too bad with the shoulder injuries, but she has obviously a bright future. Rick Pitino, the only coach to reach the Final Four with 3 different programs and the only one to win national titles at 2, has announced he will be coaching in Greece. He will be coaching a team that is based in Athens. You remember the Hall of Fame basketball coach who was fired as Louisville's head coach last year amid allegations that he was aware of illicit payments to a prospect that were revealed by federal prosecutors. Of course, there was a lot of other stuff that went down while he was coach at Louisville. I know he's suing Louisville for some of the instances that he feels he got wrongly blamed for. But he will be coaching in Greece. It's funny how all these Hall of Fame coaches find life in Europe and elsewhere after their time here in the United States. Lots of opportunities for these coaches, that's for sure. He also had stints, as you remember, in the NBA with the Boston Celtics and the New York Knicks. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back. And my first guest is the one and only Alec Sokolov. Can't wait for you to hear that conversation. And then the great Rocky Blyer. Sports Interview with Allegory is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, patented dual zone lens technology. Learn more at peakvision.com. Peakvision.com. And Sports Interview with Allegory is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. In the frosty air, what a bright time. It's the right time to rock the night away. Jingle bell time is a swell time to go gliding in the one-horse sleigh.
365 days a year, WPPB is working for you on the air and on our website. WPPB has a helpful community calendar on our site. Just go to 883WPPB.org to the Community Calendar tab and tell us about your activity or event. It's free, easy, and fast. WPPB is the voice of the community, 365 days a year, 7 days a week, on the air and online. Spread the word about your community events. Go to 883WPPB.org.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. It's so great to say good morning to somebody that I've gotten to know recently, and I admire you so much. Wow. Alec Sokolow, and I hardly even know you, so that's wow. Maybe I have to get to know you more.
It's a downward curve.
But anyway, I want to describe you as a writer, a thinker,
wow,
an athlete,
mm-hmm,
a sports fan,
mm-hmm,
and the father of Scooby.
And a father, well, a human proprietor of Scooby, a father of two actual human beings also.
Right. Father of daughter,
Eli and Maya.
I love it. And we've just really have gotten to know each other recently. But,
yeah,
so the script is just, starting. But
yes.
And you're also hosting, obviously, this show with Bridget LeRoy that airs on this radio station every Sunday. And we'll talk a little bit about that because I'm excited. I'm going to co-host with you. So we'll get into that a little bit. But most people, as you said, know you from your writing Toy Story. And Toy Story, from what I could read, was the first computer animated feature film and debut feature release from Pixar Animation Studios, released by Walt Disney Pictures. And so what a cool...
Yeah, thanks.
Project,
so
right?
I co-wrote that with a longtime collaborator, Joel Cohn. We did a lot of work together. We did the first 7 drafts of that film, kind of found Buzz and Woody for them, and created their voices, their names, their personalities, the themes, and all that stuff that writers are supposed to do.
So you created those two characters?
On the page. I mean,
Woody and Buzz Lightyear.
They were on the page. The Pixar guys were doing all the artwork and creating the universe and creating the visage, if you will. We were handling personality and character and backstories and trying to give them an emotional inner life, what we would call the Freuds.
The Freuds. I love it. So, these are characters that are in our culture forever now. I mean, if you go to Disney World, Disneyland, they're rides Woody and Buzz Lightyear.
It's my obituary, I know. But I got an email from a friend this morning who said that there's a hotel in, I think, Japan that's coming up that's a Toy Story themed hotel now. And he's like, are you going to get an annuity of that? And I'm like, I can steal the soap and the towels like everybody else. So.
Well, maybe you'll get an invite for the opening at least.
Unlike the movie. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So, there was a Toy Story 1, 2, 3, and 4. So you did the first one.
I wonder what's coming next.
Can you talk a little bit about, were you disappointed that you weren't involved in 2, 3, and 4?
No. Obviously, when you see something that you helped birth that has had success, you like to be involved. It wasn't fated to be. So I'm very blessed to have been involved with the first one. And, you know, you get into like the sausage making of Hollywood. You get into the deals and the egos and stuff. And, you know, that the first one was the one that we were supposed to do. That's that's all I can say.
Exactly. That's how it happened. And I mean, boy, nominated in 1995 for the Academy Award for
Which
Best
was cool.
Original Screenplay.
So I will tell you, and this might seem like a line. I don't like awards. I don't like awards for art. I think I get it in a way. It's kind of a carrot that people reach for, but I don't like them. And I think that they affect the decisions that people make. They distort the stories they get told. And especially for the kind of writing that I have made my career on, even if it's not a award kind of writing, it affects those decisions as well because of just the math of it. So the year before, I would sit at home, and this is what I would do, you know, at that moment, and I would, like, mock the Academy Awards. I would make jokes, snark. You know, if I could have, I would have squirted a water gun at the screen. Because I'm just like, look at all these, like, pompous people. They're so full of it. They're so sad. And then I got nominated, which was awesome. And so then it was like, then I was like, no, wait a second, awards, yeah. And so for 6 weeks after when you get nominated, every second thought is, I'm nominated for the Academy Award. I'm not, you know, you're online getting like a loaf of bread and it's like, you know, here's the loaf of bread. I'm like, hey, did you know I'm nominated for the Academy Award? And then you realize that nobody really cares, but like you and your family.
I mean, be honest with me. Did you think about an acceptance speech?
Well, the problem was that in the writing category, we had a lot of names on that.
Sure.
Some of the names were actual writers and the others were like the Pixar guys that were doing all of the animation and stuff that in the history of animation might be called writing, but it wasn't the actual screenwriting. But we had a lot of names and there's only so much time. And I kind of knew that if we were lucky enough to win. There's, you know, only one microphone and there would have been, six or seven people. I will tell you the day before I was playing pickup basketball, on Venice Beach and, I got my legs taken out from under me and I took about six stitches on my eye.
Oh,
so I went to the Academy Awards with this like real tough looking thing. And one of the Pixar guys, Andy Stanton was like, hey, if we win, I'll say we got into a fight about who was going to talk. And I was like, Andy, if you say that, I'm going to hit you with an Oscar. I know I can't curse, but that's like, that's so, you know, that's kind of it. Nice memories.
Oh my God. I love it. Well, and then the film that did win for Best Writing Original Screenplay was Usual Suspects.
Christopher McQuarrie.
Yeah.
Which was such a nifty film. And, again, this isn't ratting out Chris, but like you get to meet people. If you get nominated,
sure.
You meet and you get to, and you like people, most of them. I met Chris. I'm like, dude, I love this movie. Like, well, what did it mean? How'd you do it? Blah, blah, blah. And he said to me, just in passing, he goes, I don't know. It's the first script I ever wrote. And
wow.
And why I say that is because I had gotten a piece of advice from the writer Neil Simon when I was 22 or 23. He said, the worst thing that can happen to any writer is to have success early. And I thought, I don't believe that. But what, you know, at that moment, I would have traded places with Chris because he got the trophy. In the decade afterwards, I was so thankful that I had put in my time and learned how to be a writer. And Chris had to do that, unfortunately, with a lot of spotlights on him and a lot of pressure. And I think it really took him a while to get his sea legs.
Has he done anything?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, he's gone on. I'm not good with other people's credits. I'm hardly good with mine. But, like, he's gone on. He has a great career. But I'm just saying, little lesson there,
sure,
is that you got to put in your time and struggle. It actually is a gift if you can do it with nobody paying attention to you.
So what was your time and struggle? Talk a little bit about, you grew up in Manhattan.
I was born a poor Jewish kid from the Upper West Side.
And you ended up going to L.A.
Yeah, no, I'm like such a walking cliche. I'm like a Upper West Side rent control, you know, reformed Jewish kid who became a screenwriter. You know, it's like the choices were like...
You went to Trinity. Where John McEnroe went.
That's true, but the choices were like Communist Party or the Writers Guild, right? Like, no, I went to Trinity, which had the best tennis team ever, considering that it wasn't really a sports powerhouse. You had John, you had about four or five other high school American tennis players there. I was actually friends with John's middle brother, Mark, who isn't as well known into the public, but Mark was a great guy. We played basketball together and stuff. And then Patrick was about 4 years behind me.
And so did you know you wanted to be a writer when you were that age? Or?
No, you know, I got through my high school playing sports and I played, we didn't have a football program. I played soccer in the fall, basketball in the winter, baseball in the spring. the school actually was trying to stop me from playing so many sports, and my folks came to my defense and said, look, this is the only reason he's showing up. Like, let him show up and play these games. I also learned how to play squash because my dad was he was a six-time amateur national champion in singles and doubles in different age groups. And so I was just playing games constantly. What I did know is I hated taking tests. I also had like a processing issue that I have been working on, to how I learned and stuff. But I love writing. And so anything I can write, I got a good grade. And anything I had to like be tested on, I got a bad grade. And I carried that through college, where I tried to take every course where I can write. And in fact, there are two things I loved about I went to Penn, played squash. I got recruited to play squash at Penn and played 4 years of varsity squash there, for all you squash junkies out there. But two of my achievements in college is I never bought a Penn. I always found them on the ground, which I thought, after my like first 2 weeks there, I'm like, I'm never going to buy a writing utensil. And the other one is I once wrote one term paper and handed it into three classes. And I got an A, B, and a C. So,
Which class was the A?
Deviant behavior.
And which class was the C?
Like, there was a social anthropology class.
And what was the topic?
Schoolyard basketball is a social function. And I made up all of the data, and it was just pure fiction. But I'm like, oh, they need this, and they need this. And I can satisfy all of them, only write one paper.
Oh, my God. That's too funny. Yeah. So I always wonder, because I grew up in the Midwest with a huge backyard as an athlete myself, how does one become such an athlete in growing up in New York City? I mean, obviously, you have indoor gyms, you got the squash court, but you don't have the fields. Maybe you do. You have the...
Yeah. So again, my pop, he played college basketball and played in the Eastern League, some semi-pro basketball. So I grew up in a very sporty house. But we were close to Central Park. And that's, talk about a great backyard.
Right.
I mean, that acres and acres of any game you wanted to play at any time. And then my folks also sent me to an after school program. Both of them worked. And I was kind of a little bit of a latchkey kid. And so a bus would pick me up at 3 o'clock. And then get me home around 6 o'clock. And so I had every afternoon I was playing games somewhere in New York City.
So what brought you to Los Angeles?
Hollywood. I mean, I wanted to make movies, wanted to have a career as a writer. And I think when I was younger, I really thought it was one thing, and then you get there and you see it's something else. But it's where the work was.
And you loved your time out there? Or?
I love parts of it. I was never quite fully relaxed in Los Angeles. I for me, it was a company town, and the conversation, it was one conversation. It was either like, what deal do you have? What deal are you trying to get? What do you have out today? I could not find the off switch that easily. I had my family there. I had my mortgages there. I had my shrink there. I had everything you're supposed to have. I knew where I can get a good martini. Like, what more do you need as a writer?
It's the mentality so different. I mean, born and raised in Manhattan and then going to La La Land. I mean,
I see Southern California differently. I think that, first of all, there's a reason why like 20% of all Olympians come from Southern California. And I think another 20% come from Florida. When the weather's nice, you're going to be outside playing games a lot more. But I think that there's actually a paradox with that, which is that it's actually a very lonely place, in my opinion, and a very isolating place, and that people fill their time up playing these games because they don't want to confront their reality. Not all people, but a lot of people. And for me, that was definitely the case, where if I wasn't writing, I felt like I was falling behind. And so, yeah, I can go, surf and ski, neither of which I do a lot, but I can go do that both on the same day there, But then I'm sitting there thinking, now I got to get back to work. And that's what I'm saying. Like, for me, moving out to Eastern Long Island was really a chance for me to reclaim a little balance.
Right. And so you still work a lot out here on the East End of Long Island, but you can enjoy everything that Hamptons has to offer, which is tranquility,
absolutely,
especially this time of year.
And I'm healthier. I eat better. I sleep better. I work better. everything about me is better.
And you don't have to spend hours in a car in L.A. You're just spending at least 45 minutes driving somewhere.
Yeah,
right?
L.A. is very congested, and that's not going away anytime soon. I know Elon Musk is trying to build a tunnel of some kind, but that's true. And I mean, there are great things in L.A. They're great, but to get there, it would have been nice to be a Jetson, like to just have like a little helicopter and just like be able, or spaceship or whatever, and just, I'm going to go here now, I'm going to go there now. So yeah, there's a lot of time in your car.
Well, you credited sports for being a major reason for your successful writing career.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, like, well, I think a couple things. When you start playing games and you're coached and you then compete, there are several like skills that I think you take with you. One is how to prepare yourself, how to accept defeat, how to pick yourself up. One is how to analyze what gives me the best chance of success. You know, how do I win? How do I play not to lose, but how do I play to win? And then one also for me is how to be a teammate and how to be part of something much bigger. And so all three of those skill sets, I think, got home playing sports. And, you know, when you have a career as a writer, you have a lot of time on your own. And it requires time management, and it requires structure, and it requires understanding your place, and it requires failure. There's so much failure. Every day there's failure. Failure of thoughts, failure of ideas, failure of things that you thought you did well, but somehow it didn't work. And having played some competitive sports as a kid and having, like, you know, really loved sports throughout my whole life, it allowed me, and it still does, to, like, look at it all as a game and look at it all. How do I get better? How do I win the next time? How do I pick myself up and keep going? And so I don't think I'd have any form of my career or any other aspect of my life working out had I not had that training and that gift of competition and appreciation of it.
You did say that writing is a failure business.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I fail so much. I mean, again,
but like, in whose eyes? In your eyes, or in?
No. I had an understanding as a young writer that there's two kind of writers. There's working writers and there's non-working writers. And so I wanted to be a working writer. And anytime I can get hired, anytime I can make a living and pursue a lifestyle I want with writing, with my wits, I'm succeeding. However, it's a zero-sum game where when somebody's paying you to write a movie or a TV show or a video game and it doesn't get made, but you've been paid, you know, that's not the goal. The goal is to get something across the line and do your part and have things made. And so, you know...
But you have no control of the other part.
No, you don't have control of it. But, you know, and I stopped counting a long time ago, but I've either written or co-written or rewritten, you know, upwards of you know, 75, 85 scripts. I've had by the studios, I think 7 made by the big studios. That's not a bad rate for a screenwriter, but that's a lot of things that, you know, you live for months at a time imagining it in your mind as having been made, and then it doesn't get made. So it's, you know, it's not, to me, if you had said, if I could talk to my 19-year-old self or 20-year-old self, I'm 55 now, and say, guess what? You're going to spend your whole life telling stories and writing, and you're going to see the whole world, and you're going to meet all these people, and you're going to pay most of your bills, I would have, like, signed up. So that's not failure. That's
what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's totally successful. And to have so many, as you say, what, 7, go onto the big screen. I mean, that's...
Yeah. No, most
that's incredible.
Most people, you're lucky if you have one. And,
right.
And Joel and I had a great run in that system. We had it set up where we worked in service of, you know, 3 or 4 studios more than the others. And we went to work. And I went to work. I mean, that is, Eddie Murphy had a joke in years ago that crack don't smoke itself. And I'm like, writing doesn't happen by itself. You got to do it. So, yeah. And that goes back to sports, which is you got to do it.
Absolutely. You got to practice. You got to play. As Ted Williams was told me, and practice, practice, practice.
One of my favorite Ted Williams anecdotes I read is that he would drive from San Diego to Florida for spring trainings, and he would, like, see how few times he could hit the brakes on the car.
Cool.
I just thought that was cool. I thought that told me a lot about the guy. You know?
I loved interviewing Ted Williams because, I mean, you know, he was a co-pilot with John Glenn in the Korean War.
Yeah.
I mean, who does that?
And should be on the top 10 list of Latino baseball players because his mom, I think, is Mexican. And nobody ever talks about him. And from San Diego, nobody ever talks about him as being Latino, which...
No. This is the first I know.
Yeah.
See?
He didn't broadcast that, but I thought that was really cool. His mom was Mexican. So why not celebrate that one of the greatest, if not the greatest, hitter in the history of baseball is Latino?
Right. Right. It's, there's so many baseball players now who are Latino.
Right.
I mean, it's not a big deal now, but back then it probably would have been a big deal for people to have known that.
It's his choice. And if I outed him posthumously, I'm sorry, Tim.
He was also in the Fisherman's Hall of Fame. So
there you go.
But not putting a brake on the car.
I just remember reading that where like he would just, that's one of the ways he was always testing himself.
Yeah.
You know,
keeping his mind simulated, challenged,
yeah.
Really a baseball scientist.
Yeah.
Anybody I've ever interviewed in sports, he just was such a scientist. Well, Cheaper by the Dozen, Money Talks, Garfield the movie, Joel with your buddy, Joel Cohen. What's Joel up to these days?
You know, Joel and I, like a lot of writers, we're taking a little hiatus of
partnership.
Just being as intertwined. And so I'm going to defer that question because I don't really know.
Okay. All right. So we were talking a lot about your writing career, Alec, and how it the similarities to golf. Of all the sports that you've played, I don't know if you play
I'm a social duffer. Like I care more about going out with friends than I do about where the ball goes. But I have enough skills that I can kind of hit the ball.
I mean, you're an athlete. I'm sure.
Yeah.
You can.
But no, I'm not studied at all. And you know, I like to say grip it and rip it, but it's more just like I like going out with my buddies or
right.
whomever and just having a good time.
Right. But can you see the similarities of? Sitting down and focusing on a script and hitting a golf shot or, for a squash. I mean, squash is so much quicker, but.
No, there's absolute similarities. First of all, it's very singular. It's very abstract and it's kind of OCD in your preparation and in you're trying to make your abstractions realized in the physical world. So I think. I could tell you when I look at good golfers, I think that they're like witches or warlocks. It's so foreign to me that somebody could be that good at something that seems so hard. But I also think when I have read or heard, especially like the top golfers talk, you know, they tell a story in their mind before they go out to play the course of how they want to play the course, what their philosophy is going to be, what's going to give them the best chance of getting through the round successfully. And that's very similar to writing. I mean, I am constantly, writing is not sitting down and writing. Writing is all the time before, all the time thinking about what you're trying to accomplish. And then when you're actually there, hopefully you hit a little bit of an alpha state where you have fun in the exploration, but you've done the prep work. And so I think golf is very similar.
The process is very similar.
Yeah.
So what happens when you don't hit a good shot when you're writing? You know what I'm saying? What happens if you just sit behind your computer and you just don't have it? Does that ever happen? I'm sure it happens to you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to like age myself out here, but when I first started my writing career in the mid to late 80s, I was writing on typewriters and like very crappy word processors, and I could see why writers were alcoholics then, because it's so frustrating.
Right.
Like you get to the bottom of a page and you screw something up or you have a different thought. I could not have survived with that.
You did a little whiteout.
Whiteout stuff, but also just like that was really tough. But with computers and with the screenwriting programs and the other stuff, you could do a lot of sculpting. And even if you know, like I know, I might not be dead on, but I'm starting to mold something. So when I'm having days that aren't working, I still try and make pages, and I just like flip a different switch in my brain, which is the switch of this is going to get better. But I know I simplify it as much as I can. I just need these pages now, and there's a lot of placeholder stuff. And what's really interesting is people that read my rough drafts a lot of times will be like, "Well, you can't say that. You can't do that." I'm like, "Yeah, that doesn't matter to me." Because I'm laying pipes. Like one of my favorite screenwriters of all time is a guy named Billy Wilder. Did The Apartment, did Some Like It Hot. I mean, great old writer. And he talked about writing as plumbing and screenwriting. And I think that it really is. You're trying to connect a lot of things in a linear fashion and get things flowing in a linear fashion. And so I can have bad days, and yet they still go into the positive side of writing. Much worse than that is when I don't save something on a computer and then I lose it, which has happened several times in my career. And that's crushing.
That's devastating.
That's crushing, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it's the process, as you say. I mean, I can't even imagine doing all that writing without a computer these days. I mean, how do people?
But people did it longhand too. But we mentioned squash. And what is squash? It's like you go into a room by yourself and you hit a ball, and then maybe somebody else comes in eventually. And that's like writing. It's like I spent a lot of time like hitting the ball against the wall.
Sometimes you get the point, sometimes you don't.
Exactly.
But so the whole process, the similarity of what you do, I guess from a focus standpoint too, to sport. You know, so much of sport is really mental, don't you think? I mean,
oh, absolutely. And by the way, I was not a great competitor. And even I played all those games as a kid. I this is really tweaked, and I don't know what it says about me, but I enjoyed losing more than winning sometimes. I found winning very boring. That if, especially when I was playing squash or if I play tennis or anything, it's a singular sport. Somewhere, if I knew I was going to win or I thought I was going to win, I lost interest.
What did your shrink say about that?
You know, we were dealing with other things. But I would always have songs playing in my head, and I always would have the thing, especially, you know, squash has a lot of geometry and angles.
Right.
And I was constantly like, I wonder what would happen if I did this.
Right.
And then I guess that wasn't a good idea. And so, but on team sports, I just love playing my part. I love the idea that, like, you know what? I know where you're going to be. You know where I'm going to be. And that's going to – that there was some beautiful thing going on there. But I was not I never – even to this day, I don't really think it matters if you win or lose. I really don't. I know that that goes against America. But, like,
right.
I really don't think it matters. I think that, like, if you looked at it from Pluto, nobody would care. You know, if you look at it in that moment, you care a lot. But why do you care? Because you've set up an expectation. And why are you setting up an expectation? Because you've been told to. But why? Isn't the joy that you actually get to just live in the moment and try? That's, again,
the journey.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Process. You're into that. But
absolutely.
But don't tell me you would...
I have a couple trophies at home.
I have
a couple trophies at home, and I won the
Don't
Cal States.
Don't tell me you had tank.
I won the Cal States over 40s about 5 years ago in doubles, and so
in
I have
squash.
A little in squash,
wow,
and
okay.
So I have a little trophy for that.
That's
and
a tough sport. It's
and,
so
and,
fast.
And with a partner, I had a younger partner. We lost by one point in the Open finals. I'm competitive. I'm not like la-di-da, but I as a kid,
right?
I think I drove coaches crazy because I kind of was a little bit like Ferdinand the Bull, where like I'd be going down the one way and I'd see a butterfly or something and be like, oh, I wonder what's going on there. And everybody's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, so
just lost your focus.
There's
for
a reason why I'm a writer and not a professional athlete.
But getting back to squash, though, wasn't the most challenging part of that sport is knowing if you're playing doubles, just getting out of the way,
yeah,
knowing
well,
where to the choreography
the
of
choreography,
it to me is
yeah, and you know what? So when my dad was teaching me how to play as a kid, he actually talked a lot about that. He actually put it in basketball terms, where he kind of was saying like, look, when you box somebody out in basketball, you're supposed to do this, this, and this, and that's no different than on a squash court. So you kind of learn the flow of how to cycle out. The rules of that game are when it's not your turn to hit the ball, you have no rights. So if you get hit by a ball or get hit by a racket, it's your fault. So you learn very quickly to get out of the way. And then you also kind of understand the angles. And you can a lot of squash is understanding that a simple turn of a shoulder limits how somebody's going to hit a ball. And so then you kind of know where you
wow.
can be. So that's the real fun part of doubles for me is people. If you saw me play, you'd be like, you don't move that much. And I'm like, yeah, because I know where I'm supposed to stand. You know, like that.
And you're a big guy, so.
And I am.
They have to get out of your. They have to get out of your way.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was always more challenging for me to get out of the way than it was to get to the ball and hit the ball. I mean, you know, that to me was the art of the whole sport.
Yeah, and I could tell you, like, so in college, the coach that we had at Penn, if he didn't like our effort collectively, he would have practices where he would say, "You have to hit each other with the ball," and it would be January in Philadelphia, and the courts.
the outer wall of the courts were the outside thing. It would be so cold. And you'd be like, and so you'd say to your friends, like, all right, don't hit me that hard. I won't hit you that hard. Let's just get out of here.
Did you ever want to become a professional athlete?
And make like $17,000 a year playing squash? You know what? Of course, as a kid, you dream about that. I think that for me, I had huge confidence issues that I think that like the athletes that make it at every level see joy, and the athletes that don't see anxiety, or it's in some way. You know, some might not have physical ability, but assuming that you have some physical ability, I think that when, you know, I read an interview once with Roger Federer where he was talking about it being like, you know, deuce in the fifth set, blah, 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 and what were you thinking? And he's like, I was so happy. This is exactly where I want to be. And that's a champion thinking. I think for most mortals, it's, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. And I was a lot more like that a little bit. So, yeah, you have those dreams, and then you see a curveball. And then you actually like, oh, that's what it's.
That's what you should have been thinking.
Right? That ball shouldn't do that. And yet, you know, right. And so, you know, I would have loved to have played college basketball. It wasn't supposed to be. You know, I love baseball. That wasn't supposed to be. Squash was what availed itself, and it was really fun being on a varsity team in college. It was really fun having that inner life. And what I actually personally loved about squash is it didn't matter. It's like you could walk a block away from any squash court and nobody cared. So it was something you just did for yourself.
What athlete do you most admire? Which athlete?
Oh, golly. I love the artist. I mean, like, again, you mentioned John McEnroe. The way he approached playing tennis, Pete Sampras did the same. It's the angles and stuff. I love anybody that kind of figures out a way that they can win, and they do it, and it's artistic. I remember, like, reading an interview with Tom Seaver that was in the New Yorker about 5 or 6 years ago where he talked about the art of pitching in a different way, where how each pitch had a certain purpose, and he actually saw the strike zone almost like an artist. And I think stuff like that, more than any one athlete. Like, so I love watching professional soccer, even though I don't. But the reason I do is because every once in a while you see somebody like, how'd you figure that out?
Right.
And that's really amazing.
And you remember the story Ted Williams used to say, he could see his vision was so good. He could see the seams of the ball approaching him.
Right, he could smell the wood burning on the bat if he had fouled one off.
Yeah. Their senses are extraordinary. And with John McEnroe, certainly not a big guy physically, but he found, as you say, with his finesse way in the angles of his game and, you know, the slice backhand and forth, he found ways to win.
Yeah, and I mean, again, if I was king of all sports, I would have all the top tennis players play one tournament with wooden rackets right now. I would love to watch that artistry, because I think that in the case of tennis, there's so many heavy hitters, and it's limiting. It's not artistic, or if it is, I'm not getting it.
Right. And it's all serve and volley now.
And not even volleying. I mean, so I liked anybody that brought that magic, you know, so you could talk about Pete Maravich as a kid. Now, he did it his own way, you know, but it was beautiful to watch. You can still go on YouTube and watch me like, how do you figure that out? And anybody that was doing that kind of stuff, I dug.
And Roger Federer, he's an artistic player.
He was
beautiful
brilliant.
To watch.
Brilliant, brilliant,
his footwork,
brilliant.
His movement.
Absolutely. One of the greatest athletes. Again, an old buddy of mine is Paul Anacone, who coached Roger for several years. And I had a conversation with Paul once where I'm like, how is his shoulder not falling off? Like, all that serving. He goes, he's just one of the best athletes I've ever seen. And like, I'm not dissing anybody. I like, in the case of tennis, somebody that understands the angles, you know, somebody that's like is playing the game, carving with a scalpel, not just pounding it.
What was your first racket? Do you remember tennis?
Like a Slazenger.
My first. I don't know how anybody hit this racket, but Jimmy Connors. I adore Jimmy Connors.
The T2000.
My very first racket was the Wilson T2000, and I'm like, I look at it now. I still have it. I'm like, how did I even hold this thing? And then I went to the Chrissy Evert double-handed, you know, the longer grip, the wooden racket, which was a little
but,
more.
But at that moment in time, for me, somehow the T2000 was attached to the space program because I'm like, look at the world that's changing. And now you have these rackets made out of these, like,
that's
metal
right.
things, you know?
Exactly. Well, all right. Well, this has been fun, Alec. I mean, we should continue talking sports. We could talk for days here because you are really an athlete. I mean, I didn't realize what an athlete, you know, you are to this day, even in off course as a kid, until we started chatting a little bit the other day. And it's cool. You could be wanted to be a sportscaster, right?
I wanted to at one point. Actually, you know what? When I was a senior at college, I wanted to be a game show host. And I had read an article where I think Chuck Woolery was making like $1 million a year, only worked one day a week. And I thought, I want that job. And I went into like the career planning and I actually said, how can I do this? And they kicked me out.
I'm sure the guy looked at you like, you had like, three heads.
Yeah. You know, no, I did. I wanted to work in sports broadcasting for a little while as a kid. And then I saw what the life was and I didn't want it that bad.
Thanks a lot. It's pretty glamorous. Although you did work the Olympics in 84.
I did. I was a production assistant. I got Jim McKay his Dan and Blueberry yogurt every day, ran script copy, and was a spotter for the marathon and a couple other things like that. But that was a blast to do.
So that all kind of adds into the whole success story, all these experiences,
no,
right?
No doubt about it.
Getting yogurt for...
No doubt about it. He liked blueberry. He was very specific about that.
I'll never forget one of my first jobs at an NBC affiliate in Tampa. I went to University of South Florida, and I was so excited because I had this internship at the local station, and the... anchor, the guy asked me to get him a sandwich or something, and I thought I brought him what he asked, and he literally threw a temper tantrum and cursed me out because I bought the wrong sandwich.
Yeah.
And it was my very first day in the job, and I'm like, do I really want this?
Yeah.
I almost told him what to do, and I was a kid, but to do.
Bad treatment is not unique to show
the
business.
The egomaniacs our business, right?
But I always think that it's like that's somebody that's scared for something.
Right.
I mean, like, that's why mayonnaise isn't right. Like, why? Like, you know.
Right. Very insecure, some of these personalities in sport and in the entertainment business. Well, Alec Sokolow, thank you so much.
Best
of luck with your writing.
What joy.
And best of luck with the show here on WPPB. And best of luck with your squash game.
We're
going to get you on the golf course.
I have nothing left to prove.
I want to get you out on the links.
I'm going to take my talents to Florida.
I'll see you on the links, Alec.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Sports Interview with Alec Gorry is brought to you by Peak Vision Sunglasses, Zero Distortion, Patented Dual Zone Lens Technology. Learn more at peakvision.com, peakvision.com. And Sports Interview with Alec Gorry is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and the Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. DuneJewelry.com, D-U-N-E, Jewelry.com. I'm here with Rocky Dwyer, winner of 4 Super Bowls. When he was a running back with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann.
You look like you're in great shape.
I feel wonderful.
You look fine, even though you've been through a lot in your career, and I know now you are a motivational speaker and you talk about all that, so we want to get into your entire history, both as a football player and your experiences in Vietnam, which were incredible. I know they made a movie about it, and you wrote a book about it, the movie called Fighting Back.
Right.
About your 2-year battle to overcome the injuries at Vietnam. Take us back. You get drafted in the next to the last round.
Yeah, I know. That was the biggest.
But you were lucky you got drafted because you were shorter than most and I guess slower.
Well, you know, it was always the perception by a lot of people, one that we as individuals never really look at ourselves. I mean, I was thinking, well, you know, I look at myself in the mirror. I'm 6'2", got a lot of hair, you know. But in reality, I'm short and slow and did not have the speed that a lot of running backs, you know, had. And so my expectations of being drafted were well, maybe in the middle rounds, fifth or sixth, and when they went by, and the eighth and ninth went by. Well, at that time also is that the draft was not a big exposure like you see it today on television or in the papers, and it was almost a three-day affair. Because of time lapses and going through 17 rounds. So I never, I mean, no one ever called me and said, well, congratulations, you are, you know, the Pittsburgh Steelers have drafted you. I didn't sit around by my phones like a lot of athletes do today. As a matter of fact, I heard it on the 11 o'clock news in South Bend 3 days after it had taken place.
Hey,
Rocky Blair got drafted 16th by the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, I didn't know whether to be embarrassed by that or to be happy that I got drafted. And so I had gone to Pittsburgh then as a draft choice.
Your life is like a screenplay, so we have to cut to the next scene two here.
That's right.
You get drafted to the Vietnam War.
Yeah, so I go to Pittsburgh, and you know, and I make the team that year, and it's a 14-game season, and I get a chance to play 11 games. But within that 11-game short season, there was a lot of questions. You know, I didn't get into a reserve. There was some question about my eligibility, and so my deferment had gone. And so, and all of a sudden, bang! I get a letter in the mail that from the U.S. Selective Service that you are cordially invited to join or be drafted into the Army. Cordially invited to please report to the AP station at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning, and to be inducted into the armed services. Well, my world just, you know, fell apart at that time. Here I was, a dream come true in the minds of a lot of people, and mine as well, is that I had the opportunity to play professional football. Now I was a professional football player, had an apartment, had a car, and the next day it was taken away from me in that world, not knowing what was going to happen thereafter, and a two-year commitment into the services.
Scene three
takes me automatically right over to Vietnam.
And you're almost in a near-fatal accident. You are in a near-fatal accident.
I get over to Vietnam. I've been in country 3.5 months. We were out in patrol, ran into an ambush, got shot the first time that day with a small arms fire. AK-47 bullet went through my left thigh. We were in a firefight for most of that day. Later on that afternoon, I got hit with a grenade that had blown up and blew up through my right foot and my right knee and my right thigh. As a matter of fact, at that time, I mean, you don't worry about the future. I mean, you really worry about a life and death situation. If I'm going to get out of here, what's going to happen thereafter? And so I finally get extracted out of the jungle on about a six-hour trek through the darkness that evening until a helicopter came in and pulled us out of there. Then I went to an aid station, got patched up, and then to Da Nang, where I got operated on for the first time, cleaned up the wounds, and spent about 5 days there before I was shipped over to Tokyo, where I spent 3 weeks in the hospital before I came back to the States, where I spent 9 months in the hospital. And the prognosis basically was that you'll be fine, but you'll never play this game of football again, because the damage that had been done to at least my right foot and to the ligaments and to the muscle tissue there. Well, I had been injured before, as most athletes have, maybe not to this extent, but I didn't lose a foot, nor did I lose a leg. I was damaged, beat up, and given time, I thought to myself, given time, rehabilitation, I'll go back and play. And so what the doctor told me kind of went in one ear and out the other ear. I got a lot of support from people, or at least I didn't get any negative support, I should say. Nobody ever said, geez, you're crazy to do this. And so I was just a dumb, happy jock going through life saying, well, I can go do this again. Because basically, and I think one of the great lessons that I learned at the time is that what I really wanted to get accomplished or erase, because a lot of time we carry this throughout our life, is all those ifs and buts and could'ves and should'ves. You know, boy, if I would have done this or if I would have done that, it might have been. And so if you can erase those, then no matter where you go in life, at least you can go forward without having to look over your shoulder and carry all that garbage or baggage that we have a tendency to carry with us.
The story is only starting. And I understand it was a football move that pretty much saved your life. And when we come back with Rocky Blair, we're going to find out how it is that he has survived. that accident. We'll be back with Rocky Blair. We're back with Rocky Blair, who is trying to get all this in 1.5 hours, which is probably impossible. But your story is fascinating. You had a near-fatal accident in Vietnam, and if it weren't for that, three man over under.
That's right.
Is that right?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the exercises that yet you learn in the game of football, at least that was taught to me through junior high and through high school, is really an over under man in body control, and basically is three guys standing there. One rolls, one jumps, the other one rolls. It's kind of an acrobatic, you know, move. Right. And well, what had happened at the time when I was in Vietnam, now let's shoot that forward to that moment, is that we were under fire. I was lying up against a little hedge or the side of a road, and they were shooting over our heads. Well, my commanding officer was maybe about 6 feet from me, when all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a grenade come flying through the air, and as he was lying prone, looking out over the action, it hit him right in the middle of the back. And it didn't go off, but it bounced off of him and started to roll where I was lying there. Well, in a matter of seconds, you had to decide which way to jump. And so all of a sudden, your reactions take over, your instinct takes over. And so now all of a sudden, I go back to the eighth grade, go back to high school. And as I see this grenade coming this way, it goes to the old man over and under technique. And so as this, I had to decide which way to jump. Do I run this way? Do I run this way? But as it comes this way, I jump the opposite way, jump over it, and as I do, it blows up then. And that's where
so
I get
the impact.
So you're
in the air while this thing's blowing up.
And why this thing's
had
blowing up.
Had you just rolled over, you would have been blown up.
Probably more than likely. And as I look back on it, I always think, thank God it was a Chinese grenade. It was a Chi-Com grenade, cheaply made. So if it was one
thank
of ours,
God it was cheap.
Cheaply made, if it was one of ours, I might not be here talking to you today, but at that time, and when it exploded out this way rather than up and out this way. And so as it did, it blew out this way. I, of course, was standing on top of it. I mean, it blew me up in the air from a concussion. Shrapnel did, you know, penetrate the right leg and the foot, as I said before.
Now, you were told by the doctor that you'd never walk again, mm-hmm. let alone play football and go on to win 4 Super Bowls with the Steelers. You wrote a letter at that point to the owner at that time, Art Rooney.
That's right.
And said, I'll be back.
I'll be back. I think that was a first positive mental imprint that I had put into my mind in that I thought, I will be back. You know, I just wanted to alleviate any fears that they might have had. I'm sure that they didn't have any at all, nor that they really thought about me. But in my mind, I thought, well, I just want to let them know that I will be back and that I want the opportunity when I get back to at least try to make that team.
Do you think he felt sorry for you? Is that why he let you come back like that?
I think there was a couple of things. Is that I think there was a certain maybe sympathy about it. I mean, here was a young kid that was extracted out of their team. Went and fought in a very unpopular war. He's coming back, being the man in the family that he came from, that they were going to give me every chance and opportunity. I'm sure that in their mind they thought it would never work out, or that I would quit, or that something would happen. But there was that opportunity. And we all need breaks in our life, and sometimes you create your own break. But that first year they came back, I can remember I had gone through practice trying to make the team. The foot really wasn't as healthy and as strong as I had anticipated, and it took its toll over the two-a-day practices. And by the end of those practices, in the end of the weeks I was there, I mean, I was really limping badly until the final cut came. And Chuck Knoll, of course, as a head coach and decision maker on his players, called me into his office, a fear that every player has when he's trying to make a team, and said, geez, I think that you should go home. do whatever is necessary to get yourself back in shape and come back the following year. Well, in my enthusiasm to try to make this team, I probably embarrassed myself as I look back on it because I pleaded without almost crying,
really?
You know, is there anything that
you
I can do? And I wanted
year.
To stay that year because I always felt out of sight, out of mind.
Sure.
And,
might be harder for you to go home and come back, next year than just be there and try
and,
to...
And just be there and try to be a part of it. Well,
sure.
He said, no, there's nothing we can do. And I can remember getting in my car, tears coming down. I thought my world was coming to an end, or at least not knowing what was going to take place. When the next day, Dan Rooney, who happened to be the son of Art Rooney Sr. And president, called me up and said, I'm sorry I wasn't there yesterday when Chuck made the final cuts. He said, I'd like you to come back in. He said, I've talked to our doctors. I've talked to Chuck. They think that there's something that they can do to help you. Chuck didn't really care because they were going to put me on the injured reserve list. So it didn't take up a spot on his roster sheet. And so he said, come on back down. So they did, and that gave me an opportunity. I went back and had another operation. But again, I was there. So after that operation, being in the hospital, and when they did some more work and loosened up some of the ligaments that had really tightened up in my foot, at least I was able to go back to practice, sit in and the meetings, and work out every day and just kind of go through the therapy there. And I had an opportunity to come back at the end of the season, practiced for a few weeks, shoot it up for one game.
From the trenches in Vietnam to Pittsburgh,
Pennsylvania.
Not part of that steel curtain since you were a running back, but
right.
Part in some way, I guess. And when we come back with Rocky Blyer, we'll get more engrossed in this story. There's a lot more to get into. We'll be back with Rocky Blyer in a minute. We're back with Rocky Blyer, who went through an amazing experience in Vietnam to go back to get himself on the team with the Steelers, went on to be part of the four Super Bowl championships, and now as a motivational speaker. We'll get into that in a second. But when you look back, what was it when you were lying there and your body was injured and wounded from the grenade? What made you say, I'll be back?
Well, it was an experience. Having tasted it that one year, even it was a short part of that year, is that, I like playing professional football. I like what professional football gave me within a sense of accomplishment. And so I wanted to do that. Now, what were my options at that time? Well, I could go back and work with my dad back in the bar and run a bar, or I could go on to graduate school, or I could go out to and get a job in the real world. Well, none of the three of those really appealed to me at the time.
And I guess it was just wanting it so bad.
Badly, said, hey, and I wanted to go back, and that's what I wanted to do. And so in doing that, I mean, it really, you know, helped me define what I wanted, how important, and some of the lessons that I at least get a chance to talk to people today about in those barriers that we may face, those goals that we set, and that you really can accomplish anything you want if you're willing to do several things, and that is a belief in yourself, belief in your own talent, and willing to pay the price no matter what it might be and not lose sight of what you want to achieve and have that goal very firmly situated within your mind.
Let's talk about the Steelers of today. I'm sure you still follow the team a little bit, I guess.
It's very much so. As the Steelers have developed over the 80s, and I think that's an important criterion which we should talk about, is that they really lived in the shadow of the 70s, and especially in the eyes of the fans. And as I had retired, and as that team had retired within 80, 81, 82, and 83, and new players continued to develop and come through, is that they really, and my feeling is that those players, as a team developed, really didn't have a sense that that was their team, because all the time was thrown back, well, it's not like the 70s, or it's not the team of the 70s, or
sure.
It's
always being compared to this.
Always being compared.
Four Super Bowl championships.
And so
years.
Finally, in my estimation, the team of last year, of 89, really emerged within its own. Well, what happened this year is every year it changes is that they've changed offensive coordinators. Tom Moore, who was the original offensive coordinator, went on to Minnesota, and they hired Joe Walton,
formerly the New York Jets head coach.
And he
originally from Pittsburgh.
Originally
so
from
back.
Pittsburgh, so he's kind of back home. But what he had done was that he came in and changed the whole offense. Changed not only the plays, but changed the terminology. Well, you have a young team coming up, and I don't care how much you try to drill it into them, it takes time for them to get used to that offense.
Let's talk about what you're doing here in New York now. I know you're involved in...
I'm national spokesperson for prostate cancer, and we had gone through over the last several weeks a prostate cancer awareness week in which we're really trying to get out to men that prostate cancer, and you have to understand this, is that that is number one cause of cancer within men,
really?
And it's the second leading killer of men. And yet nobody knows about it. One out of every nine Americans, one out of every 11 Americans, I should say, a man will get cancer. And so a year ago, we had started the awareness program, and we had 91 hospitals participate, giving free examinations across the country. There are about 1.2 million men walking around with prostate cancer that they don't know about it. And so the word that I'm trying to get out is really, go see your doctor, get a check, and make sure it's part of your image.
Come full circle with this man. From Vietnam, your high school, college days, to your days with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and it's so nice to talk to you.
And thank you very much.
We'll have to do it again in part two sometime.
Part two, we'll get that one.
Thanks a lot.
My thanks to Kyle Lynch, our engineer. My thanks to Alec Sokoloff and to the great Rocky Liar. Have a wonderful holiday. Merry Christmas to you. And I'll talk to you next Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern right here on Sports Interview with Anne Liguori.